Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Cleo Wolfley Hazard, author of Underflows, Queer Trans Ecologies and River Justice, published this year by University of Washington Press. Dr. Hazard, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
To start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Well, my formal academic training began in philosophy and then moved into fine arts and photography. And then eventually, after some stints in community college, ended up with a bachelor's degree in geology, studying the Milltown Dam removal. And then in grad school, I wanted to stay in the field sciences, but really engage with local communities as they were looking at stream restoration, issues of drought, and I really wanted to work with animals and not just water itself. So I found my way to the Carlson Lab at UC Berkeley. I was a student in the Energy and Resources Group, working with Isha Ray, who's a social scientist, and figured out a way to craft a project that was grounding scientific studies of salmon and local stream flows and mutual experiences of water scarcity in local communities' priorities and really doing embedded science with a watershed council of local residents. And from there, I found through my professor Kim Tallbear this field of feminist science studies, and this was kind of the glue that held everything together in terms of how could I bring together interest in history and politics of rivers with this real passion for field sciences and critically thinking about grounding these types of studies in the lived experience of local communities, place-based communities, tribal nations. And so the book really grew out of that work that I did as a PhD student, but brought in some of these side projects that I had begun years earlier and continued along the way. So queer performance, interest in trans embodiment, and different types of autobiographical writing that I did alongside my PhD eventually came together into this book, Underflows, which is in one sense, kind of a chronicle of my training as a scientist, embodied as I am, as a trans person, a queer person, a white settler, from the West Coast of North America. And it's also a look at some of these latencies and political and social tendencies that really shape and drive these social movements and kind of practitioner efforts to revive and restore rivers.
All right, so this is a book about rivers, and I imagine we all think we know what rivers are, but could you tell us, what is a river to you?
That's a great question. And my conception of rivers, as I think everyone's is shaped by the river that I grew up near, which is a very special and also what we would call novel ecosystem in ecology, is the Los Angeles River. And so for those who don't know, the Los Angeles River flows in, for the most part, in this trapezoidal cement channel, and it almost looks almost dry. And you may have seen it in any number of films. People often driving cars down the bottom of the LA River, and then it floods, and sometimes catastrophically during rainstorms. And so this was my kind of quintessential river. And I always wondered, like, where is the water? Like, where does it go? What's under this river? I would drive out into the desert and think about water shifting. And then when I moved to New Mexico as a young person to do on the ground landscape restoration with a local natural building company, we were thinking about infiltrating water far from the river in order to increase flows in streams. And so my idea of a river then started to extend not just this channel that you might see on the map or walk along, but also the water that's slowly seeping down through the ground and eventually reaching that channel. And then, you know, as I moved to different climates and through these rivers that actually flow most of the time, which is, I think, most people's concept of a river, in California and in Montana, where I did my undergrad, I started to think more about rivers and time. And so we might walk along a river and see it as kind of a fixed channel or its banks and its water. But in fact, that where it is right now is just one trace of where it has been and where it's going to be. And so now I think about a river as these kind of past, present, and future movements of water that then shape, you know, the movement of sediment, and then plants respond, and then their roots hold sediment, and then reshape the flow of the river in turn. And then you have all of the, you know, the animal species that are contributing their bodies to nutrient cycles. And so now my view of a river is maybe six or seven dimensions, and is really a field of relations.
Okay. And so then to bring the title of the book into this, and you've mentioned a few times the concept of an underflow. So can you talk a bit about what that is, both in the kind of the biophysical material sense, and then also how you're using this idea conceptually in this a broader sense?
Yeah, so in river ecology and hydrology, we have this concept of the hyporheic zone. And so this is the area underneath the stream bed. So if you're walking along a stream, you're walking on sand or gravel, and in between those grains of sand or gravel or mud or whatever is there, there is water, unless you're walking on bedrock, and those types of channels don't have a hyporheic zone. But all of these alluvial channels that have these sediments in them have this zone where there might be little bugs living down there. Fish can swim down in spaces between gravel to escape drought, or, you know, to cool off. Salmon lay their eggs in these spaces. Other fishes do. These rocks are often coated with microbial biofilms and slimes of different kinds that do a lot of, some of them are photosynthetic, some of them are breaking down. There's a whole ecology there, like on the surface of the rocks and the little invertebrates that might graze on those algae. And so the hyporheic zone was a very powerful concept in hydrology, and kind of linked hydrology and ecology in these ways of thinking about how water downwelling and upwelling and passing through under dry river bars is cooling off or transporting nutrients or losing oxygen, gaining oxygen through microbial respiration and photosynthesis. So this is to any river scientist, you know, whether they're a hydrologist or geomorphologist or fish ecologist or an aquatic insect lover, is aware of this concept of the hyporheic. And yet most people who aren't scientists don't really think about the flows under the river. And many people, when I was writing the book, said, well, why don't you just call it undercurrents? We know what undercurrents are. And I said, no, well, underflows is if you take the Greek hypo for under and rios for flow, you know, it's actually different. The undercurrent is the part of the river itself that's under the surface that might be turbulent or moving, you know, in a kind of non-Newtonian three-dimensional way. But the underflow itself is actually that water that you can't even see, but yet is really shaping, again, this river through time. And these underflows persist after the surface flow dries up. So this was a big part of the science that I did for my PhD, was how do salmon survive in these little pools that are kind of scattered along this dry stream bed. And they're sustained in some cases by these underflows. And other times these underflows become so depleted in oxygen that they can actually, you know, cause those pools to become uninhabitable for salmon. So part of the book is talking about some of these dynamics that ecologists and hydrologists think about that to understand how streams might be evolving in response to changes in flow. And then another sense of underflows I think of is in terms of latent destinies. And this is a concept that July Hazard and I kind of July Hazard kind of came up with the concept of latent destinies, but it came out of an earlier project that we had worked on, which was a popular anthology that we co-edited with Laura Allen called Damnation, Dispatches from the Water Underground. And this was a popular anthology around dams and water protests. It came out in 2007. And in that book, we really theorize dams as this quintessential project of manifest destiny in terms of, you know, staking out the frontier, enclosing terrain, trying to channel, harness, you know, wild forces and tame them and turn them to settler, in particular, you know, these kind of masculinist engineers projects. And so July and I had written a paper together around beavers as an example of what July calls these latent destinies. So thinking with Freud, if there's something that's manifest, then there has to be a latency under it. It's like the underside or the underflow of that manifest destiny. And so then conceptually, I think about all of these different place-based projects where people are relating in different ways to the damage that's been done to rivers by resource extraction, be it damming, levee building, water diversion, forestry practices, urbanization, contamination from industry. There's all of these harms that we can think of as, you know, again, part of manifest destiny projects that are being you know, resisted and reconfigured in different ways by these place-based communities. And so I really wanted to highlight these strategies in a feminist way, in a way of that feminist geographers and others have been thinking about a lowercase Anthropocene. So if manifest destiny is kind of a more specific way of thinking about the Anthropocene in the context of the U.S. and particularly the U.S. West. And then there's other ways to think about these underflows in terms of queerness and transness as these kind of embodiments that are not typical amongst field scientists or, you know, when we find each other as queer and trans ecologists, hydrologists, other natural scientists. It's hard to figure out exactly how to bring that experience and those embodiments into river science. And yet from my own experience, I knew that difference did matter in terms of the way I was able to relate to other humans and other species in the field. And so I really wanted to think theoretically with queer and trans scholars of embodiment and performance who aren't usually thinking about the environment or about, you know, rivers or other so-called natural features, right? About how queer and trans perspectives and embodiments and subjectivities could shape the study of and management of the rivers and the land.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you didn't take those people's advice to change the title of the book, because I think the underflows gets at something different, and the, you know, the hydrological definition of it is definitely making me think, because I live in Pittsburgh and we famously have the three rivers, but people always talk about the secret fourth river. That's the underflow underneath our rivers in the city, because this is a very alluvial geology that we have. And it's like the secret thing that you know about if you're really from Pittsburgh, you know about the Fourth River.
Yes, and I think that many cities have these. I mean, there's a spring in the Powell Street BART station in San Francisco that there's a, you know, they have to constantly pump. It's like millions of gallons of water a day because they dug that BART station into the channel of an underground creek. And so, you know, there's this really great water that someone could be drinking or at least watering their lawns with that just gets pumped out of there. And I think, yeah, part of my fascination with rivers really started in these urban contexts where we laid a city over the land and yet the water is still going to find its way.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to now pick up on something you were starting to get to at the end of the last answer here, which is about the idea of queer science and trans science. So could you kind of define what you mean by those and, you know, sort of tell us what's straight about mainstream science that you're counterposing this queer and trans science to?
Again, this has a couple of different dimensions, and maybe the most straightforward one is just, you know, when I was a geology student in Montana, there's this rite of passage that is, you know, geology field camp, and everyone goes and stays in dorms and looks at rocks and for a couple of weeks, and it just sounded so cool, and I always wanted to do it. And then I was just like, man, I don't know what dorm I could even be in, and it's mostly these guys, and I'm older than them, and it just like I just decided not to go because it didn't feel unsafe, but it felt like it was going to be just awkward, or I would have to be hiding a part of myself to be there, and it just didn't seem like worth it. And then I always kind of regretted because it was in this really cool part of Montana, and I'm not a real geologist. I'm like a kind of a geomorphologist, but I always like wanted to have that rite of passage. And I think when you talk to queer and especially trans scientists who work in the field, you know, there are all of these just like little barriers or things that are just a little bit awkward, like how do you change into your wetsuit, and you know, what about going pee, and like all of these things that when we talk to each other, we talk about it, and it, you know, might seem like a little thing, but it actually ends up kind of shaping like who gets to go where and who gets to study what kinds of things. And so, you know, that's one aspect of it. And I think, you know, ecology, you know, I don't know the statistics, but if you go to the Ecological Society of America meeting, like there's a lot of women there, and there's a lot of women, you know, in ecology, maybe less so in hydrology and geology and some of these other fields that are pretty male dominated. And so, you know, it feels good to be in those spaces, right? And so part of it is like, what if, you know, what is the feminist move beyond inclusion of women, right? Would be, okay, inclusion of other people gendered otherwise, right? So that's one aspect. But another aspect of queer ecology in particular is that, you know, in the humanities and in geography, there has been a conversation starting in the early 2000s around queer ecologies as, you know, examples range from like cruising parks that are, you know, how urban spaces are figured as queer because of who inhabits them, to, you know, analyses using queer and trans theory to look at novels that might figure the environment in some way, or films, right? So kind of queer and trans eco-criticism that in many cases reduces the natural world to a metaphor and ecology, or sorry, the natural world becomes kind of a backdrop, and then ecology is a metaphor in a way that I think many people are familiar with. So, you know, we think of like the web of life, and we're all connected, and this something around, you know, biomimicry or, you know, these other ways that we can think metaphorically about the natural world. And from my engagement with Indigenous studies and also with, you know, feminist materialisms, I think it's really critical to not reduce the natural world, so-called, to a metaphor, and to take, you know, other beings, other species, and even elementals like rock and water and soil, as to consider them as relations with their own animacy, their own ways of making relations, right? And so I really wanted to make an intervention into this kind of nascent subfield of queer ecology to, on the one hand, take plants and animals and rivers, et cetera, as not metaphorical, but as real, and as persons, as some of my colleagues in Indigenous studies might say. And also another move in that field was to take queer people out of queer ecology. So I went to a talk at one point where someone was talking about a bear that had crossed the border from France to Spain. And because they were transgressing a national boundary, that bear was queer. And I just was thinking, wow, there's so many ways you could have gone with the queer bear, but that is just one that is erasing, right, queer people's experience and queer culture, right, and all of these ways that we do transgress and make relations, but simply crossing a national boundary doesn't make that bear queer. And so I kind of wanted to really dive into and demonstrate ways that we could go to queer theory that really centered queer experience. And here I am especially, you know, drawn to and impressed by and want to be in conversation with queer of color theory put the queer, like radical queer subjectivity, queer kinship, queer politics into queer ecology when we're using queer theory to think about the environment. And the third, this is kind of related to the earlier point, but the third way that ecologists think about ecosystems, like, is in terms of models. And so, you know, we do this thing where to understand these complex systems, we reduce their dynamics to numbers, and then we mathematically model the relations among these different plants, animals, water, weather, temperature, et cetera. And this is like a sense of ecology that I think is really rich for feminist science studies exploration in a similar way that Karen Barad has delved into some of the quantum physics, or Vanna Subramaniam has delved into some of the like real nitty gritty of the biology. I really wanted to try to bring some of this, the mathematical sense of an ecosystem into the field of queer ecology. And then the trans part of it is a little bit different. So the trans ecology mostly comes in through, again, building on this work that I did earlier with July Hazard on latent destinies, that paper was focusing on beavers as, you know, these figures that could inspire human engineers to build dams differently. So ecologists often name beavers as the quintessential ecosystem engineer because of the ways that they, their dams back up water, they can raise water tables, grow lots of willow trees, you know, minks and otters and fish and birds all come to these beaver ponds, and they can really transform or transfigure, as Julia and I said, these very degraded landscapes. And so people have been trying to partner with beavers to spark, you know, revitalization of riverine landscapes. And so we think it's part, one of the chapters of the book kind of takes that argument a step further to really think through transgender embodiment as a way that non-trans river restoration practitioners could think about these interventions that we have to make sometimes. So sometimes we have to get bulldozers out. I was just on a call this morning with a colleague from the Karuk tribe, and you know, we're gonna have to remove a whole levee and move several million tons of rocks from one side of the river to the other, and it's going to use bulldozers and make a bunch of scars in the landscape. And I started thinking about, you know, these cuts and scars in a way that is similar to ways that some trans people, you know, could reshape our bodies through surgery. And so Ava Hayward, in her piece Lessons from a Starfish, writes about her own gender transition, and specifically her bottom surgery, as you know, she's not transforming from a man into a woman, rather through the surgeon's, you know, cuts and folds that he's making in her body are bringing her towards herself through herself, or she says, towards myself through myself. And so I was thinking, what if we could think about, what if we as river restoration practitioners, right, people who are working on the land, could think about the watershed as a kind of trans body, and we're these agents that get to kind of make these interventions that let the watershed be more itself. And that might, if we're collaborating with beavers or collaborating with salmon or with these other willows, with these other species, with fire, we can help shape, but yet not control, right, that becoming of the watershed. And to me, this is helps us get away with some of get away from some of these binaries that are really central to manifest destiny thinking, and that have tainted the environmental restoration movement. So a lot of settler restoration has this idea of a reference state where we're going to try to get back to some Edenic pre-settler imaginary that often also erases native peoples and their very active management from the landscape. And also then we have all these novel species and novel ecosystems and new ways that, you know, that we're using the landscape now. And I think that this trans, this watershed body figure can help us kind of reconcile some of the transformations that have already taken place and the ones that are, you know, emerging more and more rapidly with climate change, and give us a way to unsettle in some ways by becoming like more humble reshapers of this body that we are also a part of.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I love that concept of thinking of like the river as like a trans body. It was one of those kind of like mind-blowing moments when you laid that out in the book. And, you know, such a great challenge to some of the like body metaphors that get used for ecosystems and stuff that have a lot more problematic connotations of like virgin landscapes and those kinds, yes, of things. So then you mentioned a few times in that answer about your work with indigenous communities. And so this is a thread through the whole book of talking about indigenous science, but from a clear position of yourself as a white settler ally. So you're not yourself trying to do indigenous science, but you're engaging in what you call a politics of solidarity. So can you talk a little more about that relationship that you have with indigenous communities and with indigenous indigenous science and kind of how you make your work as a white settler, work in conversation and collaboration with indigenous people.
Yeah, I like to think of myself as an accomplice. So this has some of the, the connotations of things that might be, slightly outside the taken for granted. Not to say that we're blowing up dams, because we're not, but that we're trying to push the limits of what can be done in terms of river management, fire, all these ways that Native peoples of North America and beyond have managed the landscapes where they've lived since time immemorial. And so so one of my early influences, even before becoming a scientist, was to work on the ground in land restoration. And one of my mentors was Louis Hena from Tisuke Pueblo. And he taught me how to drive a backhoe. And he was a permaculture practitioner, really working kind of on a holistic scale to try to restore the lands there north of Santa Fe around Tisuke. And my ideas around restoration, I realized later, were very shaped by this specifically, Pueblo perspective, but that is shared, I think, amongst many Native nations, that they've always practiced management in this reciprocal way, that was interrupted by settler colonialism, that the practice of restoration is an exercise of sovereignty, and that Western science and Western engineering and all of these things are tools that can be used within a Native context and inside of Native protocol in a way that they then become Native science and Native engineering. And so this was also shaped by some of my time at Black Mesa and the Navajo Nation doing solidarity work against the mines on Black Mesa, and just thinking about the ways that technologies, they're not necessarily Western just because they originated in England, but rather like a bulldozer is a tool, just like a pencil is a tool, and when it's wielded in a certain way, the outcomes can be really different. And so during my PhD work, I was part of a graduate student watershed governance group, and two of my colleagues, Sybil Diver and Dan Starnowitziki, were working up on the Klamath River. And we went on a field trip up there as a group of graduate students working on water broadly, water governance, and made some connections with the Karuk tribe. And at the time, I didn't have resources to really offer to the tribe, but I was very interested in, I was familiar with the Klamath from writing about dam removal my book Damnation. It was really kept thinking about those relationships and just building on them informally through visits until I was able, when I got my tenure track job, to actually offer something concrete in terms of funding, in terms of field, this field course that I co-developed with Lisa Moorhead Hillman, who's a Karuk educator and basket weaver, and she and her partner, Leif Hillman, who's ceremonial leader at Tishonic in the Orleans area of the Klamath, have become my close collaborators over the last 6 or 7 years on a series of explorations that span landscape architecture, fluvial geomorphology, hydrology, ecology, fire ecology, and ethnobotany, among other fields that we're engaging. But what we're really trying to do is restore a mining impacted reach of the Klamath River and develop a process that could be used to restore mining impacted reaches of Klamath and many other rivers, but that's centering Karuk science, Karuk protocol, and the knowledge and desires of local community members. And in that case, you know, the real goal of this river restoration project is cultural revitalization and intergenerational knowledge transfer, as Lisa and Leaf like to say, between elders and youth. And so, you know, we have a part of the project that is, you know, mapping and flying the drone and getting high resolution topography and modeling how removing this levee will affect this road that's washing out across the river, threatening homes, or that will revitalize some of the willows that basket weavers rely on that have become senescent. This project at Shoshonic is involving a lot of different disciplines, from landscape architecture to fluvial geomorphology, ecology, ethnobotany, to reconnect the river, but to do it in a way that is starting from Karuk people's relationships to one another on the land. And this was the Karuk tribe has most of the land that was reserved in the treaty era was never turned into a reservation, was instead turned into national forest. And so now, in order to access their resources, the Karuk tribe has to form all of these relationships with many different government agencies, as well as, you know, nonprofits and universities, to kind of get the funding to do the management on their land, since they don't have a land base as such. They have a small land base for housing and things. So Shoshonic, this area we're working, is a really important, it's one of the three urban centers, ceremonial centers, and also a place that was out of tribal ownership until 2015. And beginning in 2015, when it was returned to the tribe, there was this opportunity to reconnect the river. And so I write about this in the conclusion just a little bit, but how some of these conversations across Native science and queer ecology have been really productive. And a lot of my thinking has kind of grown about what queer ecologies might be, have grown through these conversations with Lisa and Leaf and others in that community around these touch points between Indigenous notions of kinship and queer ways of making family. And also, yeah, different political solidarities that have that have occurred through, you know, different queer people's involvement in American Indian movement and the fish wars and other struggles. So some of these connections are kind of directly relational, and some of them are more conceptual, but I found it really, really rich with my, you know, Karuk collaborators and with other colleagues in Native studies, to think about what are the different disruptions that queer theory and Native theory around, you know, kinship can make to settler, colonial, white, supremacist, heteropatriarchal structures. And similarly, you know, or kind of also, you know, what are the trans theoretical interventions into notions of gender that might be able to act in solidarity with you know, Native masculinities, femininities, other ways of being embodied, you know, as a gendered person. And so it's also been really interesting, you know, working in these rural spaces and bringing, because of who I am and who my students are, I end up bringing a lot of queer and trans students to these rural communities. And some of them, you know, there's different politics and kind of different, you know, the Mid-Klamath is like Karuk tribe and a lot of hippies. And then I work in the Scott Valley, which is, you know, Quartz Valley Indian community, and a lot of pretty conservative ranchers, and I've brought a lot of queer and trans students to both of these spaces. And in, say, we're here doing queer and trans ecology, let's move this river back. And that, you know, makes its own ripples or waves or whatever water metaphor you want to use, right, into those local circumstances.
All right. Well, I think we've given our listeners a good sense of what this book holds in store for them. So to kind of wrap up our conversation here, can you tell us about what you're working on next?
Yeah, so I have this project on the Klamath that I talked about a little bit, and then I have a new project here in Seattle on the Duwamish River that's also super exciting to me. So the last chapter of the book goes down to the shores of the Duwamish, which is a very industrial river, a super fun site, and thinks with Jose Munoz's theory of the brown commons about, you know, what how in what ways the Duwamish is a queer ecology, and in what ways queer ecological thought could reshape the ways that people are trying to restore that river. And so when I was first moved to Seattle 5 years ago, I spent a lot of time in the Duwamish, just, you know, poking around, biking, canoeing, you know, crawling around on the mud flats looking for detritus. And then was kind of waiting for an opening or an invitation to actually work in the restoration space there. And as I was writing this chapter, you know, kind of theorizing the brown commons as a queer ecology along the Duwamish, this other project started to develop. And so I'm working with a number of different grassroots environmental justice groups, with the Duwamish tribe, and then with colleagues from couple different campuses at University of Washington, namely Melanie Malone, Dr. Melanie Malone, and Dr. Catherine D'Almeida. And so we have this super exciting project that is doing community-directed contaminant sampling and kind of community science around this Duwamish River. And because of those partnerships and more work with youth, there's a lot of opportunities to bring in some of the artistic methods that I highlight a little bit in the book. And so photography and some performance and other ways of reimagining this urban space. So I'm not exactly sure where that's going as an academic project, but it's super exciting to be working in the urban area again and focusing on these intersections between arts and sciences and community action.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. I'll be keeping an eye out for that new work. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been lovely.
You just heard a conversation with Cleo Wolfley Hazard, author of Underflows, Queer Trans Ecologies and River Justice, published this year by University of Washington Press.